This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Anthony Ramos, stars in what's expected to be one of the big summer movies, the film adaptation of Lin-Manuel Miranda's Tony Award-winning first musical, In the Heights. Ramos is in the role Miranda wrote for himself and played on Broadway. In Miranda's musical Hamilton, Ramos was in a dual role, playing both the abolitionist John Lawrence and Hamilton's son, Philip. In the Heights is a very kinetic film, and Ramos sings, raps, and dances, including in some exuberant big production numbers. In contrast, Ramos is also one of the stars of the current HBO series In Treatment, in which each of his episodes consists of him talking in a Zoom therapy session with his therapist. The fact that he's great in both roles shows how versatile he is. Earlier, Ramos co-starred in the Netflix adaptation of Spike Lee's film She's Gotta Have It, in the role Lee played in the film Mars Blackman. In Bradley Cooper's adaptation of A Star Is Born, he played the best friend of Lady Gaga's character. Anthony Ramos grew up in the projects in the Brooklyn neighborhood of Bushwick. In the Heights is a love letter to the Latinx neighborhood Lin-Manuel Miranda grew up in, Washington Heights. The story is about two generations of people, the older adults who came to America with a dream, which typically was never or not quite fulfilled, and the young adults who grew up in New York and have their own dreams. Ramos plays Usnavi, who owns a corner bodega and dreams of returning to the Dominican Republic, which he left when he was 8. When the film starts, it's a hot summer day. In the opening song, we meet Usnavi and some of the other people in the neighborhood.
I am Usnavi, and you probably never heard my name. Reports of my fame are greatly exaggerated, exacerbated by the fact that my syntax is highly complicated, because I immigrated from the single greatest little place in the Caribbean, Dominican Republic. I love it. Jesus, I'm jealous of it. And beyond that, ever since my folks passed on, I haven't gone back.
God damn, I gotta get on that.
Four. The milk is gone bad. Hold up just a second. Why is everything in this fridge warm and tepid? I better step it up and fight the heat, cause I'm not making any profit if the coffee isn't light and sweet.
Ooh. Abuela, my fridge broke. I got café, but no con leche.
Ay, Dios. Try my mother's old recipe. One can of condensed milk.
Nice. Oh, hey, your lottery ticket.
Paciencia y fe.
That was abuela. She's not really my abuela, but she practically raised me. This corner is her escuela now. You probably thinking, I'm up this creek.
I never been north of 96th Street.
Well, you must take the A train. Even farther than Harlem to northern Manhattan and maintain. Get off at 181st and take the escalator. I hope you're writing this down. I'm gonna test you later. I'm getting tested. Times are tough on this bodega. 2 months ago, somebody bought Ortegas. Our neighbors started packing up and picking up, and ever since the rent went up, it's gotten mad expensive, but we live with just enough.
In the Heights, I flip the lights and start my day.
Anthony Ramos, welcome to Fresh Air, and congratulations on all these new projects. It's great. So what did In the Heights mean to you when you first saw the show?
Well, thanks for having me on the show. And In the Heights means a lot to me. First time I saw it on Broadway in my last semester of college, I started auditioning already for shows, and I was going to open auditions, open calls, waking up really early in the morning, getting after it. It was really difficult, like, starting out, because you see people looking at you like, we don't know what to do with this guy.
Wait, because you were Puerto Rican?
Yeah, I don't know why. You know, I think it was, I mean, he's Latino, but the role needs to be white, or the role needs to be, you know, and then they hear me speak and they're like, but he sounds New York. We need somebody to speak with a more neutral dialect. And I'm like, all right, well, cool. Like, you know, I can work on that for the piece, whatever it is. But I think it was just like, I was running up against wall after wall after wall. And finally I like sat and watched this show, and I just saw all these characters on the stage, and they just felt like I was like, yo, I feel like I'm watching my cousins and my aunts and uncles on this stage right now. Like, friends that I grew up with, and these people are speaking the vernacular that's familiar to me. And these, you know, this music feels familiar to the music that I grew up listening to. And this the pulse of this musical, like feels, it feels close to me. And I hadn't felt that watching a musical ever. You know, I didn't even grow up watching musicals because we just didn't in my house. But I think watching In the Heights, it just gave me this hope, like, wow, this is what a Broadway show can be.
So, you know, In the Heights is a story about a block and the people who live and work on that block. And it's a really tight-knit community. This is like a very idealized version of where Lin-Manuel Miranda grew up. Compare that to your neighborhood. You grew up in Brooklyn in the projects.
Yeah, I grew up in Bushwick with my mom and my two siblings, my older brother and my younger sister. Predominantly Latino neighborhood, Puerto Ricans, Dominicans, Mexicans. It was what we call barrio. Like, it was rough. But they would, you know, it's funny. Washington Heights, the pulse of that neighborhood, though, the music and the food and the, you know, like just people yelling from their windows out, you know, to someone downstairs, or the kids, you know, opening the fire hydrants. It was, you know, there were all these similarities, right, between the neighborhood I grew up in and Washington Heights, and I lived up there. I lived up there after college for a little bit.
So you describe your neighborhood as being rough. Who were you in the neighborhood? What were you known for?
I was always playing sports. I was always trying to keep myself busy. I was, you know what I'm saying? I mean, I wasn't the best student. I just had problems focusing in school. But I was always kind of outside. I always wanted to be outside. Baseball was my thing, though. I think baseball was like my lifeline. I loved playing ball. Like, that was my thing. You know what I'm saying? I didn't really get into trouble. I get into trouble sometimes, but it was like, you know, thank God I didn't really find myself too many times running around with the wrong crowd. Every now and then I'd be like, dang, yeah, no, we definitely get in trouble for this, or I'm in the wrong place at the wrong time right now. Or, you know, there was a lot of violence and drugs in my neighborhood, alcohol, people selling drugs, gangs, you know, so it was a thing, you know. But I thank God for my mother, you know, and she was very, very protective. You know, she was always, you know, even though she knew she couldn't really, like, we were going to do whatever anyway, but she was very as protective as she could be.
In spite of you. Yeah. So your mother raised you as a single mother. What did she do to support the family?
My mom was a medical biller. I think she worked for like one or two hospitals. I think she was making like $30,000 a year before taxes. You know, my mom worked at a laboratory on the weekends to make some extra money, and she did what she had to do. That was how she put food on the table. I mean, some weeks we knew it was rice and chicken, rice, beans and chicken every day. You know, we had to stretch it out. It was, you know, whatever was the cheapest thing she could afford that she could whip up that week. But you know, my mom's a warrior.
But you lived with your aunt when you were 12. You moved in with your aunt. Is that too personal to ask you why?
Nah, so I moved in with my aunt when I was 12 because I was applying to high schools. And I applied to this one school. My cousin Xavier, my aunt Emily's son, he's, you know, we were thick as thieves. We were so tight as kids. And I always wanted to play baseball with my cousin. I said, imagine if I get into New Utrecht, like if only I could get into the same high school as him, we'll get to be on the same baseball team. It's crazy. That was the only reason I applied to the school. And in the New York public school system, you apply to 11 schools. And, you know, usually you'll get picked by the school that's closest to where you live. New Utrecht was like the last school I put on the list. And it was a joke. I was like, that school's so far from where I live, they'll never accept me. And I put 10 other schools on that list. And sure enough, New Utrecht, I got in. And I said to my mom before I applied, I said, Mom, if I apply to New Utrecht and I get in, can I go live with Edie Emily? Because she lived 5 blocks away from the school, as opposed to me having to travel on the train for an hour and 15 minutes. My mother was like, if you get in, yeah, you can ask. I got in. I looked at my mom. I said, yo, can I live with Diti? She looked at me and she goes, well, if you want to live with her, you got to ask her. And I was like, okay. And I went and asked my aunt, and I could see the shock on my aunt's face. Like, yo, did he really just ask me if I'm gonna move in, if he can move in with him? And, you know, and I could see the weight of that and the lack of time that she had to process that all on her face at the same time, like in that moment. And she said, yeah. And I went and lived with my aunt for 3 years, my, you know, freshman, sophomore, and junior year. But then, you know, I was being a little hard-headed, so my aunt politely asked me to leave. So I moved back in with my mother. But at that point, I was so used to not living in my mom's house that I was bouncing around. I mean, I'd stay over friends' houses. I had like an itinerary every week. It was like, all right, stay over Jason's house Monday and Tuesday, and stay over Luciano's house Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, and then ask Didi Emily if you could at least stay one night here, and then you'll go to mom's house for one night, and then you'll do it. You switch the rotation up next week. Like, it was like that. I was like a nomad. I was bouncing around.
You got into acting school, the American Musical and Dramatic Academy, with the help of a high school drama teacher who was your mentor, and it sounds like she really changed your life. She helped you apply. She helped you, I think, with the admissions essay. She helped you get a scholarship from the Jerry Seinfeld Foundation. So what was your admission essay about?
Wow, that is such a good question. I don't even know. I can't even remember what those essays, but I'm sure Sarah would remember. I know I had to, you know, I had to write about my life, and so I'm sure it was probably something about how I grew up and what that was like. And, you know, I know I did say in the interview, though, I remember interviewing for that scholarship, that, yes, yeah, I mean, Sarah, she, you know, she was a high school director. She directed the Theater Guild, right? So the school used to have a theater guild, and she was running it. And, you know, I auditioned for what I thought was a talent show, ended up being a musical because I wanted to sing again. I hadn't sang since eighth grade. I auditioned for this thing. I sing Ordinary People by John Legend. And that was my joint too. And then she goes, okay, read these lines. I was like, I don't do that. She's like, what do you mean? This is a musical. And I'm like, oh, well, all right, cool. I did it. They gave me a lead part in this show. I'm like, I don't know if I could do this. She's like, I think you can. I did it and I fell in love. And then fast forward to my senior year, I'm applying to schools and I was going to go to school to play baseball. That was what I wanted to do. And Sarah, like, you know, all my applications get withdrawn because I missed the deadline for the financial aid forms. And she was like, hope is not lost, because I was feeling hopeless. And I was like, I think I might have, you know, I was thinking about going to the Navy. She was like, yo, before you make any decisions about anything, you need to audition for this one school called AMDA. And she's like, you should audition. And I was like, all right, I go on audition. I get in. Couldn't afford it. I was like, this is crazy. They sent me the amount of what it was going to cost. She said, gave your name to the Jerry Seinfeld Scholarship Foundation. I said, do they know what my grades are like? She's like, yes, it's okay. They still want to meet you. I was like, oh, snap. And I sit with this woman named Kate Fenneman, who's still a friend of mine, a good friend of mine. And I just told her my story. And I basically just said, I need a shot. I just need somebody to give me a chance. My grades are not, they're not a reflection of who I am. You know, so I just need a chance. You know, we got emotional and I shared things about my life, my, you know, how I grew up, and I left, and school's calling me for this crazy loan. Couldn't afford it. I asked the guy to give me one more day, but like 2 hours later, Kate calls and says, hey, Anthony, okay, you know, we don't usually give the scholarship out to people with your grades, but we want to pay for your school for all 4 years.
How do you thank people for these kinds of things? You know, like, these are people who just changed your life, who gave completely. You this incredible opportunity.
Completely. And, you know, it's funny, like a full circle moment happened recently where I just gave my first scholarship with Kate.
Oh, wow. That's great. That's great.
Yeah. Yeah. To this girl named Najalees. And special girl. She lives in the Bronx. Special young woman. And it was just a crazy full circle moment because Sarah and Kate worked together to pick the people who were in the running, and then pick, you know, the final two. And then, you know, we all came together and we picked Najalees. And it was just so wild to think that, like, I'm teaming up with the two women that gave me a shot. They are the ones helping me do that for someone else. And I said, how special is that? You know, and I thank them all the time. They changed my life.
Let's get to Hamilton. So what did you do to audition for the workshop of Hamilton? Like, what was the audition like for you?
Well, Hamilton, you know, speaking of Radio City, I was doing that Spring Spectacular. I was doing that spring show that they were trying to put up. And I had just come back off a cruise ship.
Oh, doing a show on the cruise ship?
Yeah. I was doing Saturday Night Fever, the musical.
Oh,
on,
wow.
A Royal Caribbean cruise line. Came back to New York. I was like, I got to get my face out there. Like, nobody knows who I am. And I had no agent, nothing. So I was just like, I got to start getting out. So I was going to open auditions. I went to Telsey. This was the casting company that was casting for Hamilton's mixtape at the time was the name of it. I went in for something else. It wasn't even for Hamilton. It was just another show. And I was like, yo, I don't even know what this musical is about, but I'm just going to go and sing a song. So that way I can get in front of a casting director. And I do these auditions before I went to rehearsal for Radio City. So I had time in the mornings to run to these auditions. I did that audition. They didn't call me back for that show, but the casting director says, hey, we want you to audition for this thing called Hamilton's Mixtape. And I didn't know what that was. Next thing you know, I saw Lynn wrote it. I was like, oh, you know, because In the Heights, I knew about In the Heights. And I was like, yo, this is the same team that did In the Heights. Oh, this is crazy. Whoa, like, I went in and I auditioned. The casting director said, I don't know how this is going to work out with this Radio City schedule, but you're really right for this. So I'm gonna call you back. And I said, okay. She kept calling me back. I did four auditions later. I'm in front of Lynn, Tommy, the whole team, everybody. And I do the material and I left and I went to Radio City rehearsal and was so crazy. I get to rehearsal and we get a note on the board where you sign in saying, everyone don't bother signing in, please. Come to the large rehearsal hall. We have a meeting. I was like, I think we're fired. And then I see a cast member like rushing from the left of the wings from the stage and she's bawling. And I said, oh, we're for sure fired. And I went upstairs and sure enough, there were 77 cast members get laid off and go back to the dressing room. Cause we started partying. We were like, all right, well, we're gonna go out with a bang. This is it. We're all done. And I get a call like 3 hours later, maybe like late afternoon. And it was Bethany Knox, the casting director at Telsey. She says, hey, we heard about Radio City. We'd love for you to be in Hamilton's mixtape. And that's how that happened.
Wow. What serendipity, what luck. Well, let's hear you from the cast album of Hamilton. And this is Blow Us All Away. And you're Alexander Hamilton's son in this role. You're 19. You're a recent graduate of King's College, and you're angry about a classmate who has publicly disparaged your father. So here's my guest, Anthony Ramos, in the cast recording of Hamilton.
Meet the latest graduate of King's College. I probably shouldn't brag, but dad got amazing, astonished. The scholars say I got the same virtuosity your brains as my pops. The ladies say my brain's not where the resemblance stops. I'm only 19, but my mind is older. Gotta be my own man, like my father, but bolder. I shoulder his legacy with pride. I used to hear him say that someday I would
blow us all away.
Ladies, I'm looking for Mr. George Eaker. Made a speech last week, our 4th of July speaker. He disparaged my father's legacy in front of a crowd. I can't have that. I'm making my father proud.
I saw him just up Broadway a couple of blocks. He was going to see a play.
Well, I go visit his box.
God, you're a fox.
Hey, y'all look pretty good in your frocks. How about when I get back, we all strip down to our socks?
Okay. Yeah. Blow us all the way.
George,
I'm trying to watch the show.
You should have watched your mouth before you talked about my father, though. I didn't
say anything. So that's Anthony Ramos and the cast recording of Hamilton. My understanding is that you recorded the cast recording sitting on a stool because you had just had appendicitis and were still recovering from the surgery. So when did you, were you like on stage or something when you got the appendicitis?
It was in between shows. It was a two-show day. I'll never forget it. I was in excruciating pain. Like I was sitting in my dressing room and I was like, let me at least try to take a nap or something. You know, I was trying to eat lunch, couldn't do it. I was like, all right, let me lay down. Pain was so bad I had to call out. I just told my stage manager, I can't do it. I'm so sorry. I was in so much pain, I didn't even go back to Brooklyn. I just stood in my brother's place in the city. He lived pretty close to the theater. And I was like, yo, can I just like come to your crib and lay down? He's like, yeah, bro, no doubt. And I sit there, I'm just like, yo, this ain't normal. This is different. This pain is different. I don't know what this is. We got to go to the hospital. And we went, and we went straight to the hospital. I think it was Mount Sinai. And they're like, yo, you have appendicitis, bro. I was like, well, what does that mean? They're like, well, you need surgery. I was like, well, yo, I literally said, can we do it like next week? He was like, no, we have to do this now. And I was like, what? And sure enough, they take me into that room. They take my appendix out. It was crazy. I was on all these drugs and whatever. I was like, yo, what just happened to me in the last 48 hours? And we had just opened on Broadway. We just opened. So,
oh, that must have been killing you. This is like your big shot and you're in the hospital.
Yeah, it was rough. And then the doctor's like, yeah, you got to be out of your show for a month. I'm like, bro, if I'm out of the show for a month, yo, I don't get paid if I'm out of the show for a month. I was like, what are we doing? I was like, yo, we weren't making a lot of money off Broadway. I couldn't save money when we were off Broadway. We just got the Broadway, bro. I'm broke. That was to think about it, right? Are you going through this life or death situation with your appendix? And the thing I'm thinking about is like, yo, I got to pay my rent, bro. And I was supposed to be out of the show for a month. And, you know, we cut it down to 2 weeks. They modified the show a little bit for me, my parts, or some of the more physical things. They made some adjustments so that way I could come back early until I was healthy enough to do the show at full speed, which I was so grateful for. But it was like, and then we recorded the cast album. We recorded the cast album shortly after I had this appendectomy, and I had to sit on a stool in the studio in between takes. I would stand up, cut my vocal, and then I'd sit on the stool.
Did it hurt to breathe while you were singing?
Sometimes, yeah. It was. I had to really be mindful of how I was breathing. Like, if I didn't need to take a deep breath for that note or whatever, don't do it. Like, it was definitely a chess match with myself. But I was like, I ain't missing this. Y'all ain't making this cast album without me.
Anthony Ramos, it's just been so much fun to talk with you. I just really appreciate it very much. And congratulations on this time in your life and all of these like fantastic opportunities and performances.
Well, thank you. Thanks for having me, Terry. I appreciate it. This has been an amazing talk. I've enjoyed this so much. So thank you. Thank you for having me.
Anthony Ramos stars in the new film adaptation of Lin-Manuel Miranda's musical In the Heights. He's one of the stars of the current HBO series In Treatment, and he has a new album called Love and Lies. Our film critic Justin Chang recommends two very different fantasy movies, one for all ages and one for grown-ups. The Pixar animated film Luca, set in and around a small Italian coastal village, is streaming on Disney+. The German drama Undina, set in present-day Berlin, is available on major platforms. Here's Justin's review.
By curious coincidence, two of the lovelier movies I've seen so far this summer, the family-friendly animated fable Luca and the German art house fairy tale Undina, tell stories about mythic sea creatures making contact with the human world. That's hardly a new concept, as we've seen in films as different as The Shape of Water, Aquaman, and countless versions of The Little Mermaid. But as Luca and Undina demonstrate, there are still fresh stories to be dredged up from those watery depths. Arriving on Disney+, several months after the Oscar-winning afterlife comedy, Soul, Luca is a lighter, mellower brand of Pixar confection. It also happens to be a better, more smartly realized movie. It takes place in and around a small Italian Riviera town whose residents live in fear of the sea monsters rumored to dwell in the surrounding waters. One of these fantastical creatures is Luca, a sweet young boy with blue fins, green scales, and a long tail, who lives in an underwater grotto with his overprotective parents. He's voiced by Jacob Tremblay, the lead in a strong cast that also includes Maya Rudolph and Jim Gaffigan. Like the Little Mermaid herself, Luca becomes fascinated by the world above the ocean's surface. One day he ventures ashore and finds that after drying himself off, he takes on human form. But he has to be careful never to get wet, or he'll be exposed as a sea creature, a supernatural conceit that sets up a lot of the gags in this literal fish-out-of-water farce. Luca's guide to the human world is another boy-slash-undercover sea creature named Alberto. In this scene, Alberto shows Luca his home in a stone tower just outside town. It's the beginning of a beautiful friendship.
Mother of Pearl. You live up here?
Yeah, me and my dad. He's not even here a whole lot, so I pretty much just do whatever I want.
Isn't it dangerous?
Yeah, it's the best. Everything good is above the surface.
Like, what else?
Air! Gravity, also known as falling! The sky, clouds, the sun. Whoa, don't look at it. Just kidding. Definitely look at it.
Eventually, Luca and Alberto make their way into town, which is gorgeously designed in a way we've come to expect from Pixar. The director, Enrico Casarosa, working from a script by Jesse Andrews and Mike Jones, composes an exquisite visual love letter to Italy's cobblestone streets and scenic piazzas. Luca and Alberto befriend an outgoing young girl named Julia and enter a local triathlon where one of the events is, what else, a pasta eating contest. But in embracing their new life on dry land, they also run the risk of being exposed, and even harmed, by the townsfolk, with their superstitious fear of sea monsters. When the trailer for Luca was released weeks ago, its images of two boys running around a lush Italian paradise led more than a few to wonder, half-jokingly, if Pixar had made its own version of the gay love story Call Me By Your Name. While there's no romance in Luca, the subtext is hard to miss. After all, Luca and Alberto are struggling to conceal their true identities in a society that shuns what it doesn't understand. Theirs is a charming story about friendship, adventure, and learning to live without fear. The title character in the melancholy drama Undina is also a water sprite who takes on human form, though any similarities between the two movies pretty much end there. And Undina, or Ondine, is a famous nymph from European mythology, though the German writer-director Christian Petzold puts his own spin on the legend. This Undina, played by Paula Beer, lives in present-day Berlin and works as a city historian. You wouldn't guess that there's anything supernatural about her, or that she's bound by a single rule. If a human lover betrays her, she must take his life. We see her preparing to do just that early on, when her latest boyfriend, Johannes, tells her he's leaving her for another woman. Petzold takes a somber, realistic approach to this outlandish premise. There are no obvious visual effects, and Undina's mythological origins are never spelled out. But the story unfolds with such sly matter-of-factness that I soon found myself immersed in it. Before she has time to deal with Johannes, Undina is swept off her feet by another man, Christoph, and the two plunge headlong into a love affair that consumes them both, and like most of Undina's love affairs, is not fated to end happily. Christoph is played by Franz Rogowski, who appeared together with Paula Beer in Petzold's previous film, Transit. The actors are captivating to watch, and their reunion here adds to the movie's faintly otherworldly feel. Petzold likes to use genre to illuminate different chapters of German history, and Undina is no exception. His filmmaking is so elegant and concise that you may not realize he's slipping in a lesson on the history of Berlin itself, a history of war, devastation, and reconstruction to which Undina has long borne witness. She's a truly timeless heroine in a movie that I've seen multiple times now, and which becomes more mysterious and magical with each revisit.
Justin Chang is film critic for the LA Times. He reviewed the new Pixar film Luca and the German film Undina. Our guest, Renee Elise Goldsberry, won a Tony Award for her performance in Hamilton and a Grammy for her work on the cast recording. She's now one of the stars of the new comedy series Girls 5 Eva that's available on Peacock, NBC's streaming platform. She spoke with Fresh Air's Anne-Marie Baldonado.
You probably already know Renee Elise Goldsberry from this. That's her playing Angelica Schuyler in Hamilton. She was also in the Broadway productions of Rent, The Color Purple, and The Lion King. She was on TV shows like Ally McBeal and The Good Wife and the soap opera One Life to Live. And now she gets to show off her comedy chops, not to mention her ability to parody 90s pop songs, in a new show called Girls 5 Eva. It just got renewed for a second season. So here's the plot. It's about a one-hit wonder girl group from the 1990s whose members have dropped out of music and have pretty much been living in obscurity. One of them's even a dentist. But when a hip-hop artist decides to sample one of their old songs, people remember. They perform together for the first time in decades on a late-night show and end up deciding they want to keep performing. They fire their sexist manager, who took advantage of them when they were younger, and decide to write their own new songs. They want to make it in music again, as a group, even though the odds are against them. The executive producer of Girls 5 Eva is Tina Fey, and you can tell. The jokes come fast and feminist, and the songs may feel like you know them from the 90s, but the lyrics make fun of the misogyny of those times. Goldsberry plays the character Wiki, who tried to hold on to the success and fame with a solo career, but it never took off. She's still pretending to be a social media influencer, but in reality, her job is shooting geese at the airport. So when the group gets the second chance, Wiki thinks that finally the world will recognize her talent. In this scene, Wiki's trying to convince her bandmate, played by Sarah Bareilles, to get the group back together.
I was never done with music, okay? After I went solo, the label decided I was difficult just because I wouldn't let my backup singers wear makeup and refused to play venues that also did sports. I thought this little stink of stuff was going to be my ticket back to the fame and the lifestyle I am owed because of the voice God put in my mouth.
Renee Elise Goldsberry, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you. I'm so happy to be here.
Can you describe your character, Wiki Roy?
Wiki is desperately in need of a second chance. She is a woman who believes that stardom was destined for her. And she also is under the misbelief that she needed to climb over everybody along the way to achieve her dreams. And when we meet her, we discover that that did not work out for her. And she has a pretty hard lesson ahead of her to figure out how to turn, I think, what is a beautiful talent away from being something that's cancerous in her and into something that really lifts her and everyone around her up as high as possible.
I think part of the reason why people love this series is the songs. They sound just like they're supposed to sound genre-wise. They sound like songs from the late 90s, early 2000s from girl and boy groups, but they also make fun of the lyrics. Do you have a favorite song of the ones you sang?
Oh my gosh. Well, Dream Girlfriends is this one song. We are dream girlfriends because our dads are dead. So you never have to meet them and get asked why you left school. Like, they're just so random.
There was like the line about Tarantino. Like, I love Tarantino. I like stand up, but not by women.
Exactly. Like, there, you know, and that's every single song from The Splingy to Famous Five Eva to, you know, they're just so brilliantly constructed. They walk this line between being real songs that somebody would put out in the 90s, like you said, making fun, actually kind of making us aware of some of the ridiculous things that we might have thought, but also being just good enough to make it on an album, but you understand why it didn't make it as a hit.
One of your breakout moments was in a production at Shakespeare in the Park, the musical Two Gentlemen of Verona, and you got great reviews. The Times called you, what is it?
I can tell you. Oh, you, I remember.
Yeah, tell me. What did the Times call you?
A spark plug of musical wit and vitality, I believe it says.
So this was a show in Shakespeare in the Park. What year is...
This is 2005.
2005. So what did that show... What was the impact on your career?
It was huge. It was huge. I remember when I got the soap opera, I was still on the soap opera at the time. I remember my fear of the job was that I would be not written for, but in a contract where I, you know, I was just sitting there and I couldn't do anything else. And the beauty is the opposite happened. They did end up writing for me and I had an opportunity. My executive producer, Frank Valentini, used to let me do all the theater in the world. He's made it work. And Kathleen Marshall cast me to play Sylvia in Two Gentlemen of Verona opposite Norm Lewis with Rosario Dawson and Oscar Isaac. And there I was in the show because Kathleen Marshall just took a chance on me from my audition. I was nobody. And she created this amazingly interesting, fantastic character. They put this great huge afro on me and engineered some amazing boobs somehow in this dress. I had the greatest music written by Galt, you know, McDermott and John Guare. And for whatever reason, the sun literally went down and the moon came up and the stars started shining on my number every single night in the park. So there was a lot working for me, and it was amazing. I got great reviews, and it definitely was the turning point in my career from being a working actor in a soap opera who could, you know, replacement cast people in Broadway shows to being an actor that could actually originate, you know, parts and shows that people actually would look to me and actually give me a shot. And I used to, I would come out from the theater and people that had totally ignored me in auditions. I mean, they were doing that Dreamgirls movie. Like, I couldn't even get past the first round in any of these auditions. You know, 2 weeks later, I'm in Shakespeare in the Park, and these same casting directors would be begging themselves to just get me to say hello to them. And all of this happened in my career at the moment that I was pregnant. I was 3.5 months pregnant, and I remember thinking, this is so ironic because my career is finally going to happen, and all I want to do is go paint a baby room.
So then what was your next role after?
I got cast to be Nettie in the first Broadway production of The Color Purple. And I remember being at that audition, and I sang something. And then before I left, they actually sat me down. It's the only time this has happened for a Broadway show, where they sat me in the room and they all told me that they were praying that I would take the job. I didn't even have to leave for them to tell me that. And I remember being like, I can't believe this is happening, because I hadn't even told my manager that I was pregnant. And so I remember calling her afterwards and saying, they just gave me this job. Call them and say thank you and let them know I can't do it because I'm pregnant. And she told them that I was pregnant, and they gave me the job anyway.
Gosh, was it hard to make those kind of decisions? I mean, I don't know if it's changed at all as far as whether or not, you know, you have to make tough decisions being pregnant as a stage actor. And it's different, right? Because, I don't know, it's there. You're on stage. It's very physical.
Yeah. In any profession, it's hard for women to make choices and decisions about having a baby. And it's always hard. First of all, it's just hard to have a baby. Let's start there. Whether you're trying to balance it with a career or a job or not, that's got its own challenges. And when you think on top of that of having to use your body to do the job, it's scary and it's hard. And fortunately, because it was hard for me, because I had some miscarriages early, it really got my priorities right. When I was in The Color Purple, I was designed to be there for just a couple of months, and they were building dresses that could grow on me so that I could leave right around 6 months of pregnancy. But right before I left, I lost the baby. It was a pretty, you know, very devastating second trimester loss. And, you know, I stayed for a couple of extra, like maybe an extra month after that, just until they could recast me and left the show. And I, you know, I think it's interesting because I, you know, kept living and had children and my life went on, but part of me always felt like there must be some sadness and pain remnant with that company and the producers for The Color Purple, because they were a part of that. I don't know if they felt in any way responsible. I don't know how they felt. But when I was standing on the stage, you know, accepting a Tony for Hamilton, I didn't think it was an accident that it was the 10-year mark for Color Purple revival. So when I looked out at the audience, I saw those producers sitting in the audience. And I wanted to say, look, you know, we made it. It's okay. You know, it's really, I get emotional thinking about it, but it was a beautiful thing. Cause I think sometimes like victories can happen in your personal life and you want to just share them.
Yeah, no, it's hard. And, you know, thank you for talking about miscarriage, because I think that that's something that maybe is more talked about now, but even as, you know, even like 5 years ago, it felt less so. And, you know, I've had a miscarriage, and it's just like, it's very, I don't know, you just don't know who to talk to about it. It's very difficult, but it's so common. So sometimes, you know, just hearing that it's common helps, I think.
I think hearing that it's common helps. And I also think hearing women not feel responsible for them is important. I don't know that you can separate, you know, in your identity, like your success in having children. Like, I think we need to separate that from who we are. I think there's something that feels like somehow or another we're responsible if it doesn't work out, even if it's totally science. And I think, you know, not only talking about the fact that, hey, I had one too and it's okay. I think the other one is to say, and I take no responsibility for the fact that, you know, that pregnancy didn't work out, but this one did. Like, you know, this is the way my life was supposed to go. Take it from me. Stay on the road. You will get to where you're going and it's okay. You know, give yourself a break.
Is it harder, and if this is too personal, just let me know. Is it harder because I feel like, particularly the way you perform, or like, you know, on Broadway, how people perform, it's so physical. I think when people have miscarriages, they sometimes do blame themselves. Is it hard when you're like, have to be that physical in your performance, in your work life?
There is absolutely times when women need to be on bed rest and they're told, you know, you can't do this set of things. And that is just one instance of what can happen in a pregnancy. In my particular case, it seems ironic, but like my successful pregnancy happened when I was hanging upside down the rafters in Rent, performing like at the closing night of Rent. My body actually needed to be under a lot of physical stress, I learned in like my whole journey, in order for a pregnancy to be successful. So I think every case is so unique and so different. But what I love so much about women in the public eye, I mean, I'm definitely not the only one. I mean, almost every television show I've been on, whether it's, you know, The Good Wife or, gosh, you know, so many shows, the woman that was number one on the call sheet also had a baby there. I remember seeing Audra on stage and Shuffle Along. She was shuffling along on a tabletop. I don't know. Was she 4 or 5 months pregnant? I don't know. I'm actually doing a documentary about this with Kelly O'Hara, and I remember seeing Kelly O'Hara in a production pregnant. Like, there is something about a woman in her second trimester that is superhero-ish, you know, and we really can do anything. And when you get to watch a woman on stage pregnant doing all that and just proving it to you, there's nothing more exciting in the world. So I really lift up all the producers that took that chance, you know, that take that chance. And I mean, it's risky business and it's worth it. So I hope they continue to.
How did you become involved with Hamilton? I think Lin-Manuel Miranda and Tommy Kail, the director, wanted you, but you were hesitant at first?
I don't know that they wanted me, but let's say that.
Okay.
No,
they totally did.
They just needed a woman that could rap this really fast, hard rap. And there's a million wonderful performing women, many of them I know well, that could do it. But they just needed to make sure that they were hiring a woman that could do that rap and satisfied. But Lynn and Tommy did not know me. And so I came in and auditioned and I did my version of Satisfied for them. And when it was over, Tommy slid a glass of water across the table because clearly my mouth was a little dry and asked me to do it again. They gave me some notes. I sang at the piano with Alex Lacamoire and they gave me the opportunity to play that role in the off-Broadway, actually before off-Broadway. It was the workshop of the show. And I spent the next couple of years fighting to hold on to that part.
What do you mean?
Well, I think there's a thing about being recast. I mean, I've been in workshops of shows where they brought somebody else in after me that they thought was going to be better for it. I think I probably replaced an actor or two. I know a couple women I think I replaced that were in earlier workshops of Hamilton. And I just didn't think I could live in a world where I almost had this role. I knew it was the greatest production I had ever. I'd never seen anything like it. The closest was In the Heights when I saw it on Broadway. I knew the role was special. I knew there was just magic everywhere. The magic was distracting. It was hard for me to even focus on doing my job in the play because I was looking around at all the magic around me on the stage. It was like nothing I had ever encountered, and I didn't want it to have come through my hands. I wanted it to stay.
Now, I want to ask you about that song you mentioned, Satisfied. It's a big number. And for people who, I don't know who these people are, but for people who don't know Hamilton, Satisfied is kind of an emotional high point for you in the show. You're narrating the events that have just happened through your perspective. And whenever I hear the song or see you in the movie version of the play, it just seems like this huge feat because, you know, there's choreography and then it's just this huge feat of breathing. And I just don't know how you got through it. But we're going to hear a little bit of it right now.
I remember that night, I just might regret that night for the rest of my days. I remember those soldier boys tripping right over themselves to win our praise. I remember that dream like candlelight, like a dream that you can't quite place. But Alexander, I'll never forget the first time I saw your face. I have never been the same. Intelligent eyes in a hunger-pang frame. And when you said hi, I forgot my dang name. Set my heart aflame, every part of flame. This is not a game.
You strike me as a woman who has never been satisfied.
I'm sure I don't know what you mean. You forget yourself.
You're like me. I'm never satisfied.
Is that right?
I've never been satisfied.
My name is Angelica Schuyler.
Alexander Hamilton.
Where's your family from?
Unimportant, there's a million things I haven't done. Just you wait, just you wait.
So this is what it feels like to match wits with someone at your level. What the hell is the catch? It's the feeling of freedom, of seeing the light. It's Ben Franklin with the key and a kite. You see it right. The conversation lasted 2 minutes, maybe 3 minutes. Everything we said in total agreement. It's a dream and it's a bit of a dance. A bit of a posture, it's a bit of a stance. He's a bit of a flirt, but I'ma give it a chance.
That's Renee Elise Goldsberry as Angelica Schuyler from the movie version of Hamilton. Renee Elise Goldsberry, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you for having me. Thank you for doing all that you do.
Renee Elise Goldsberry spoke with Fresh Air's Anne-Marie Baldonado. Goldsberry is one of the stars of the series Girls 5 Eva, which was just renewed for a second season.